Well, it's good to see all of you here this morning. Started off beautifully bright, but clouding up outside, but not inside, I think. In fact, the good song we've sung, the good prayer we've had, should prepare us for a day of worship to the Lord. It's been so good to have various ones visiting through the week. It's good to have Brother Dana here this morning. I've appreciated so much their involvement in the work in Belize. Sorry for the occasion that brings him here, but we do appreciate that work and rejoice to have the opportunity to let them know of our fellowship and love. And I want to mention the Wiggins presence from Farallon, who came and have been here Friday, Saturday, and now this morning. Certainly an encouragement to us. We came to love them very much while we were working there, but we loved them before that, really, but our affection has increased. They've been a great support and encouragement, and it's certainly an encouragement to have them here this morning. I want us to study a brief lesson from the book of 2 Samuel, the 13th chapter. If you wish to turn there and read with us, why, that will be fine. We'll have some of it at least here on the screen. Beginning with verse 1, the writer tells us that after this, Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister whose name was Tamar. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Now, Tamar was the daughter of David by one wife, and Amnon was the son of David by another wife. So they were half brother and sister, but he loved her. And Amnon was so distressed over his sister Tamar that he became sick, for she was a virgin. He was lovesick, I guess. And that sometime can bring on pretty serious consequences. It was improper, the statement is, that Amnon should do anything to her. And if the Bible contains any understatement, that's it. Because it was altogether improper. In the first place, she wasn't interested in him. And in the second place, they were not married. And there is no right for sexual relations of any kind between two people who are not married. But in the third place, it would have even been unlawful for them to marry. Because for half-brother and sister to marry, after the law was given, would have been sinful and wrong. But he still loved her. And he had a friend. Amnon had a friend. That's the beginning of the third verse. And who that friend was is really the part of the rest of the story. The rest of Amnon's life, really, depended on the kind of friend that he had. There are two kinds of friends, of course. There are good friends. And what do you expect of good friends? Well, what you expect may not be really what you get if you have a really good friend. A really good friend is going to discourage you in any sin you may consider. A good friend is going to tell you when you're wrong. A good friend is going to encourage you always to do right. And the association with a good friend is always going to encourage you in righteousness simply because of the example of that good friend. The Bible tells us about some good friends. David had some good friends. In fact, earlier in his life, there was a time when a woman, the name of Abigail, had kept him from doing something very, very serious. It was the time during that time when David was fleeing from Saul, and he had a group of men who roamed the countryside and really performed a service in the protection of various individuals and their property from marauding groups and bands that might go from place to place. And there was one of these men by the name of Nabal who had considerable holdings. And David's men protected him from those who would have harmed him and stolen his goods and his sheep and his cattle. And so when he was harvesting and shearing his sheep, which was a time for festivity, David sent to get his tip, I guess you would say, sent some men there to collect a little bit because of the service that they had rendered. But Nabal said in verse 16, or 10 rather, Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away each one from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat and that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men whom I do not know where they are from? Get on away. Get on away. I don't want to have anything to do with you." Well, the men came to David. It says they turned on their heels. That's an expression that's become common. And went back. And when David heard about this, he said, "Every man gird on his sword." So every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. They were going down there to kill every male in Nabal's household. Well, Nabal's wife was a wise woman. And so she determined to try to do what she could to stop what was apparently inevitable. So she gathered up a lot of good things to eat, raisins and other grapes and other things. And she went to David and carried this gift to him to plead with him not to do what he was about to do. And David was entreated by her. And in the 32nd verse of this 25th chapter of 1 Samuel, David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel who sent you to this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from avenging myself with my own hand. For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hastened and come to meet me, surely by morning light no males would have been left to Nabal." She was a real friend. She stopped him from doing something that he later, doubtless, would have regretted. David had another friend. You remember that after he became king, he committed adultery with Bathsheba and then caused her husband to be slain in battle. And Nathan the prophet came to him and told him a story about a man who had many, many sheep, but he had a neighbor with only one ewe lamb, a very poor man. And when the man who had many possessions had a visitor come, instead of taking one of his own sheep, he got the one ewe lamb from the man who lived nearby, the poor man, and killed it and fed it to his guest. And David was angry. "The man that did this will surely die." And Nathan said, "You are the man." Now that must have hurt. It must have hurt deeply. But Nathan was David's friend. And when someone sees you do wrong and comes and tells you you're wrong, that person is a good friend. Not only that, but a little bit later we have a man by the name of Naaman who had leprosy. And most of you know the story of Naaman's leprosy. He was a captain of the Syrian army. And a little girl from the people of Israel who had been captured became his friend by telling him where he could find healing. But he went to the prophet eventually, first to the king and then to the prophet Elisha. And Elisha, instead of coming out and waving his hand, you know, Naaman had it all figured out how it was going to happen over the sore place. He said he just sent a servant out and said, "Go wash seven times in the River Jordan." Well, Naaman was insulted. In the first place, the prophet didn't come out, just sent a servant and told him to wash in the River Jordan. He said, "Our rivers in Syria are just as good as this River Jordan." And he was going away in disgust and anger. And some of his servants came and said, "If the prophet had told you to do some great thing, you'd have been willing to do it. But now, this is such a simple thing. Why not go ahead and do it?" And so he did, and he was cleansed. So the little shepherd girl, the little slave girl, was his friend. But those servants that urged him not to be angry and disobedient, but rather to obey, they were good friends. Good friends are good examples, and you're going to come a lot nearer doing what's right when you are surrounded with good friends who have high ideals and good morals. That's what a good friend will really do for you. On the other hand, there are some that are bad friends. And the sad thing is that many times we consider them good friends. They will tell you what you want to hear. They're not nearly so concerned with what's right or what's true, but if they think you want to do something, they'll tell you, well, that's the right thing to do. Go right ahead. That's okay. They will even rationalize. When you are worried about doing something and how wrong it would be, they'll find out reasons why really it would be okay, you know, just go ahead with it. Or they may suggest some ways to implement your sin, and they may even help you to do it. The Bible describes such bad friends in numbers of passages of Scripture, and a great deal of the sin that's committed in the world is a result of bad friends. Well, the question is, what kind of friend did Amnon have? Well, let's read. Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. Now, Jonadab was a very crafty man. And he said to him, why are you the king's son becoming thinner day after day? Will you not tell me? And Amnon said to him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Now, if he had been a good friend, he'd say, well, you're going to have to forget this. This is not right. We'll find you another girlfriend, or we'll go off somewhere so you can just forget about her, because that's just a no-no. But that's not the way he responded. Jonadab said to him, lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, please let my sister Tamar come and give me food and prepare the food in my sight, that I may see it and eat it from her hand. He's making suggestions about how to do what really was wrong, what was evil. Well, that's the kind of friend he was, if you can call him a friend. That's the kind of advice that he gave. Well, what did Amnon do? Amnon foolishly followed the advice of his so-called friend. He did just exactly what the friend suggested. Asked that when his father came, he asked that she come and prepare food for him. She came and prepared food for him, and he, as he began to eat it, asked that everybody be turned out, sent out of the room. And to use just a very forthright statement, he raped her. That's what he did. All because of the friend that he had. The consequences were significant. The consequences were terrible. In the first place, Tamar was seriously wronged. There's no wrong that can be done to a young woman that is any greater or more serious than to rob her of her virginity. But I'm going to turn that around the other way. There's no wrong that can be done to a young man that is any greater than to seduce him into sinning. Sometimes we make a double standard there, but there's not a double standard. It is wrong for a girl to seduce a boy or to increase his lust, his desire, just as surely as it's wrong for a young man to take advantage of a young woman. It was a dreadful sin with terrible consequences. And once a young lady is robbed of her virginity or a young man of his purity, life will never be the same. Now, there can be forgiveness, of course. There can be repentance. There can be... but many times lives are actually scarred for the rest of their days by such sin as this. It's something that is not to be dealt with lightly. But in addition, Amnon hated her. That's a very interesting fact, isn't it? That as soon as his lust was satisfied, he hated her. Now, what that means was that he really didn't love her in the first place. He just wanted her. And all too often, that's what we mistake for love. But love, we're told, desires the good of the one who's loved, the good of the object of love. The one we truly love, we will protect from evil and seek to do to help rather than to hurt or to harm. Love is not selfish. And far too much of what's called love these days is just plain selfishness. It's a desire for what I can get. And when a boy and a girl marry, the future depends to a great degree on whether they really love one another. Because if they love one another, each one is going to want the well-being of the other. Each one is going to want to help and benefit and bless the other. But if it's just lust, then it's what I can get out of it. And when two people marry for what they can get out of it, they're probably going to be disappointed because they're not going to get what they wanted to get. And consequently, in their disappointment, the marriage may very well break up. That's what happens, isn't it? Again and again and again. And why? I'm not getting what I want. But marriage is not a matter of giving, getting, it's a matter of giving. Loving someone enough that you really want to make them happy. When that's what drives it, the marriage is going to be successful. But when it's a matter of getting, so often when one either gets what he wants or doesn't get what he wants, it winds up more with hate than it does with love. But of course another event took place. Absalom, her full brother, hated Amnon for what he had done, his half-brother too. Hated him and just waited for the opportunity. And 2 years later, he called him down to where he was shearing sheep and murdered him. Amnon murdered his brother within the family of David. And then Absalom was exiled from David for this reason, for a period of time. And when he came back, he rebelled against David and stirred up a civil war in the land, trying to take the throne away from his father David. And in the process, Absalom himself was killed. So now Tamar has been spoiled, and Amnon is dead, and Absalom is dead, and a civil war has taken place in the country, all because Amnon had a friend. That's just the kind of consequences that can grow out of a bad friend. A bad friend. What would be the story of the rest of your life? The rest of Amnon's life was determined by the kind of friend he had. And I'm going to suggest to you that the rest of your life may well depend on the kind of friends that you form. It will depend on the friends you make, actually, in elementary school. Many a child begins a life of rebellion, a life of causing problems, because he has a wrong friend in elementary school. It can be reversed, but those early friends are very, very significant. And then when you get to high school, of course, it becomes even more significant, because now there is the romantic concern that has developed. And the wrong kind of friends can lead you into sin, into immorality, into bad marriages, into rebellion against authority, and just so many other things. It's so urgent that in high school you choose good friends. And this much is very important, I think, and I don't know how to impress this enough. The best friends, as a rule, and I will say as a rule, because there are exceptions to it, but the best friends are those who are in the Lord's church, or children of those who are in the Lord's church, and have principles of morality that are consistent with the teaching of the Scriptures. And a great amount of the influence in one's life is going to depend on where their friends are. If their friends are in school, so many times even the very best of friends in school have moral principles that are not sound, or they have doctrinal ideas that are bad. And if the center of your life is in high school rather than being among Christian friends, then it's possible that there are going to be problems growing out of that. And then when you go on to college, it's even more that way. Several years ago, I held a meeting in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, when Brother Quill Cope was president of Middle Tennessee State College, they called it at that time, an out-state university, a large university. And Brother Cope said this to me. He said, when students come to our university from various cities in Middle Tennessee, where they've been members of the Lord's church, he says, just about everything depends on where their social life is centered. He said, if they lose their faith, it's not because of the English department or the science department or the philosophy department. He says if they lose their faith, it's because their social life is centered in the college, in the fraternities, in the sororities, in the life of the college. He said if they come here and the church is the center of their lives, they simply go to class and prepare their lessons. But when there's a social event that's of significance, it's in the church, it's among Christians, then he said they're going to be all right. They'll be all right. And I've seen that over and over again since that time, living in Atlanta. I've seen that when students came to Emory or when students came to Georgia Tech, if the church was the center of their lives, in the first place, usually they did better in school. They made good grades in school. But in addition to that, their morals remained pure and they're clean, and they became stronger Christians instead of becoming weaker Christians. That's such an important thing. And parents need to cultivate that. It is so important that when our children are even in junior high or middle school, whatever you call it around here, and high school, that they be given opportunities to be with Christian young people. Now, sometimes that's rather costly. It may be costly in gasoline money these days to get them over to somebody else's house where a group of young people are getting together. If you have them in your own home, it's going to be costly in food. I can tell you that. I had 5 children. It's going to be costly in your peace of mind because the noise is going to go on sometime pretty far into the night. There's a little bit of cost involved in it. But I want to tell you, it's the best investment that parents can make to see to it that their children have their very best friends among good Christians in the local congregation or, if necessary, in other congregations within driving distance. And these days, that's considerable. And parents need to be aware of that and in those very important formative years encourage their children in Christian friendships. Friendships with those who have the same standards of morality and doctrine that you have. When students go on to college, it's so important that they have Christian friends. And when you go away somewhere to work, or when you go into the service, or as boyfriends and girlfriends, to have your friends among Christians. I was really impressed. I spent a little while, 3 months, in Australia a number of years ago. And the churches were very small and very scattered. And yet, making friends among Christians was major for the young people who were thinking of marriage. And many times, if there was a gospel meeting 500 miles away, if they could get away, they'd go 500 miles and stay there during the meeting and make friends there. And then those friends would come to their place when there was a gospel meeting. It was a big camp out usually in gospel meetings there. And I recall that when I was with a congregation in Bundaberg, where I spent most of those 3 months, that there was a young lady who started dating a young man. And I heard some of the older ladies saying, she's been dating him 4 weeks and hasn't had him to church yet. And they were getting ready to talk to her about that. That was getting serious already. The boy didn't have any spiritual interest, apparently, and she wasn't taking a stand. And there were very, very few instances of people marrying people that were not Christians because that was so much emphasized. We don't emphasize it enough, I'm afraid. It's not a law that you can make, and I'm not saying a person is living in some kind of sin, but I'm saying that the priorities are in the wrong place. When we marry somebody who is not a Christian, when you can't share the things that mean the most to you, then you're in real trouble. And when you marry, you should be marrying somebody who's your friend. And if that friend doesn't share your values, then you're going to have a life that's not going to be as pleasant and as meaningful and as spiritually uplifting as it could be. And there's much danger even beyond that. Even after couples marry, they still need to be careful about their friends, even those friends within the church. It bothers me a little sometimes, and that may be old-fashioned, But to see couples that get too close to other couples and take all their vacations together and in many instances maybe camping together, and sometimes the restraints. We had one lady in a family that I knew who just said, "We have a little circle around our family that nobody else has any business invading." And every family should have that, a little circle that is special to that family, that, where no one else really invades. And when two couples get too close together sometimes, that circle is crossed. And we need to be very, very careful about that kind of thing. I'm spending more time than I realized on some of these things. There are some scriptural warnings, of course. "He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will be destroyed." Think about that. And that's not simply adults. It's true of children. Those who live with children who are not wise will actually suffer the consequences. And do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? You take a lump of unleavened dough, and it doesn't take but just a little leaven to put into that lump, and before long the whole lump will be leavened. And in 1 Corinthians, Paul is describing what happens to a church when there's a little sin in it that's not dealt with. And in our own lives, just doesn't take very much coming in for friends. And here I want to say something else. The people we watch on television become our friends. And the people we interact with on the internet become our friends. And the people we text message become our friends. And those friends can be extremely dangerous. If it's somebody in the school, we observe their whole life. If it's somebody in the neighborhood, we observe their whole life. If it's somebody in the church, we can pretty well observe their whole life and know who they are and what their character is. But when they're text messaging us, or when they are on the internet just exchanging messages, they just tell us what they want us to know. And they may not tell us the truth. They may tell us falsehoods. And to form friendships among people we really don't even know is the most dangerous, perhaps, of all the methods and ways we use to choose friends. And it doesn't take very much coming from the television or from the internet to make us, to spoil us. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And then 1 Corinthians 15:33. When I was a child, I learned this verse. My dad had a class on Sunday nights, and we had to learn verse after verse after verse. And one of them I learned out of the King James Version, do not be deceived. Evil companionships corrupt good morals, I believe is what the King James says. Doesn't matter really what translation you have, the idea is there. Evil companionships. Well, what is he talking about here? Well, he's not necessarily talking about drunkards. He's not necessarily talking about thieves, though that certainly would be true. But in this particular passage, he's talking about associations with people who don't have the same faith you have. And I was rather surprised when I started preaching and found that this verse was right in the middle of a chapter about the resurrection. And what he's saying is, people who don't believe in the resurrection have as their philosophy of life, it's in the verse before, "Let's eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." And I don't blame them. If there's no hereafter, then do whatever you want to do right now. Get as much out of life as you can. All the pleasure, all the enjoyment you can get out of life now, because when you're dead, it's the end of it. That's their philosophy. On the other hand, if we believe that there is life after death, that we're going to have to give an account to God for the manner in which we've conducted ourselves, and that how we've conducted ourselves is going to determine whether we spend eternity in heaven or in hell, then that's going to make some difference. It means we're going to live with some discipline in our lives. Well, I believe in the resurrection. Don't you? Yes, I do. And you do. But when we associate with people who do not believe in the resurrection, and they live their lifestyle based on their feeling that they're going to have to get all the pleasure out of life they can, it's mighty easy for us, while we talk about believing in resurrection and talk about judgment and talk about heaven and hell, it's mighty easy for us to start acting like they're acting. And I think that's exactly what this passage is saying. When your major associations are with people who don't have the same faith in eternal consequences of life, if you're not careful, you're going to start acting like them, even though you intellectually still believe the same thing you did believe. So here is a warning, a serious, significant warning about our friends. If your friend then is like Jonadab, you need to change friends. And that's not easy. It's not easy to change friends. And I've known of adults who just moved to another town because they had the wrong friends. And I commend them for it. I knew of one instance where a man, a good Christian man, was beginning to form a relationship, or not a relationship, but some feelings for a woman in the church who was not his wife, and she had her own husband. And he just moved out of town immediately and has lived a pure godly life and been a useful man, and the woman has been too. It may sound drastic, but if that's what it takes, then do it. If it takes making everybody in school mad at you, you do it. You just don't fool with bad friends. You just need to change friends if you have the kind of friend that he had. If you can't find a good friend, it'd be better not to have any friends. Just to go your own way alone, rather than to have the wrong kind of friends. And if you don't have good friends, maybe it's your fault. Maybe you've been looking in the wrong place. Did you ever go in a place and to shop for groceries or something and find out you were in a hardware store? You say, I'm just shopping in the wrong place. And a bar or a dance hall is not the best place to find your friends. In fact, it's not a good place at all. Far better to find them in places where godly people live. And it just may be that you don't really like friends who are as pure and good as they ought to be. You better be careful. If there's something just a little bit attractive about somebody that's a little worldly, about somebody that's just a little bit risque, a little bit tells some jokes that are not real good, or dresses in a way that's not real good, if that kind of person is attractive, you've got a problem in your own mind, your own thinking. And you need to change your way of thinking. If you just can't find a good friend among the people you know, there's one you can depend on. What a friend we have in Jesus. You say, well, that's just not very practical. Yes, it's just altogether practical. Now, let me close by turning to the book of 2 Timothy, the 4th chapter. This is a passage that has just intrigued me for a long time. The Apostle Paul was in the city of Rome. And I've kind of contrasted this. In fact, I started thinking about it, I guess, about the time O.J. Simpson was on trial. And then there were others that came along later. But anytime you saw a picture of O.J. arriving at the courthouse, there were all these fans that were around outside. And then he'd go inside, you know, and you'd have a battery of lawyers and friends all around him. And then he'd come out, and there'd be those friends out there, eager to see him, and supporters. Well, I contrast that with what I have here in 2 Timothy, the 4th chapter. This was not a secluded courthouse, very probably. Trials in Roman days were in huge buildings where crowds, like a big mall, where the crowds were just milling around. And, of course, they would be eager to hear a trial. And if the person on trial was a little unpopular, they didn't hesitate to jeer and laugh at any point that was made. Beginning with verse 16, Paul says, "At my first defense, no one stood with me, but all forsook me." Paul had had friends in Rome. Some of them walked probably 35 to 40 miles to meet him when he first arrived in Rome. And he wrote a letter to the church in Rome and named numerous people in the church there. But now that he's on trial, there are perhaps 1,000 people crowding around. And he's all by himself. But was he? Verse 17 said, "But the Lord stood with me." He had faith enough in the Lord to know that the Lord was there with him. And he said, "He strengthened me so that the message might be preached fully through me, that all the Gentiles might hear, and I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion." There are going to be times when nobody will stand with you. Possibly no friend will support you. But if the Lord's with you, that's all you really, really need. And when our faith is as strong as it ought to be, the unseen Lord is just as near as the friend we see. That's